murdered someone with an axe. While I was glad to jumpstart the discussion, all the attention gave me this weird feeling that someone was going to object and fire me. I had to reassure myself that this was absurd. Still, the clamor made me realize how incredibly hard it would be for someone in a less senior position to ask for or admit to this schedule. We have a long way to go before flex time is accepted in most workplaces. It will only happen if we keep raising the issue. The discussions may be difficult, but the positives are many. We cannot change what we are unaware of, and once we are aware, we cannot help but change. Even a well-established institution like Harvard Business School, HBS, can evolve rapidly when issues are addressed head-on. Historically at HBS, American male students have academically outperformed both female and international students. When Nitin Noria was appointed dean in 2010, he made it his mission to close this gap. He began by appointing Youngmi Moon as senior associate dean of the MBA program, the first woman to hold that position in the school's century-plus history. He also created a new position for Robin Ely, an expert on gender and diversity. Associate Dean Moon, working with Professor Francis Fry, spent the first year rigorously examining the school's culture. They visited each classroom and discussed the challenges women and international students faced. Then they used that knowledge to create what Dean Noria calls a level of mindfulness. Without calling for major overhauls, they tackled the soft stuff. Small adjustments students could make immediately, like paying more attention to the language they used in class. They laid out a new communal definition of leadership. Leadership is about making others better as a result of your presence and making sure that impact lasts in your absence. They held students responsible for the impact their behavior had on others. Those who violated that principle, or even hosted an event where that principle was violated, were held accountable. The second year, HBS introduced small group projects to encourage collaboration between classmates who would not naturally work together. They also added a year-long field course, which plays to the strengths of students who are less comfortable contributing in front of large classes. By commencement, the performance gap had virtually disappeared. Men, women, and international students were represented proportionally in the honors awarded. There was another benefit, too. In a result many considered surprising, overall student satisfaction went up, not just for the female and international students, but for American males as well. By creating a more equal environment, everyone was happier. And all of this was accomplished in just 2 short years. Social gains are never handed out. They must be seized. Leaders of the women's movement, from Susan B. Anthony to Jane Addams to Alice Paul to Bella Abzug to Flo Kennedy to so many others, spoke out loudly and bravely to demand the rights that we now have. Their courage changed our culture and our laws to the benefit of us all. Looking back, it made no sense for my college friends and me to distance ourselves from the hard-won achievements of earlier feminists. We should have cheered their efforts. Instead, we lowered our voices, thinking the battle was over, and with this reticence, we hurt ourselves. Now I proudly call myself a feminist. If Tip O'Neill were alive today, I might even tell him that I'm a pom-pom girl for feminism. I hope more women and men will join me in accepting this distinguished label. Currently, only 24% of women in the United States say that they consider themselves feminists. Yet when offered a more specific definition of feminism, a feminist is someone who believes in social, political, and economic equality of the sexes. The percentage of women who agree rises to 65%. That's a big move in the right direction. Semantics can be important, but I don't think progress turns on our willingness to apply a label to ourselves. I do think progress turns on our willingness to speak up about the impact gender has on us. We can no longer pretend that biases do not exist, nor can we talk around them. And as Harvard Business School has demonstrated, the result of creating a more equal environment will not just be better performance for our organizations, but quite likely greater happiness for all. Chapter 11. Working Together Toward Equality. I began this book by acknowledging that women in the developed world are better off than ever. But the goal of true equality still eludes us. So how do we move forward? First, we must decide that true equality is long overdue and will be achieved only when more women rise to the top of every government and every industry. Then we have to do the hard work of getting there. All of us, men and women alike, have to understand and acknowledge how stereotypes and biases cloud our beliefs and perpetuate the status quo. Instead of ignoring our differences, we need to accept and transcend them. For decades, we have focused on giving women the choice to work inside or outside the home. We have celebrated the fact that women have the right to make this decision, and rightly so. But we have to ask ourselves if we have become so focused on supporting personal choices that we're failing to encourage women to aspire to leadership. It is time to cheer on girls and women who want to sit at the table, seek challenges, and lean into their careers. Today, despite all of the gains we have made, neither men nor women have real choice. Until women have supportive employers and colleagues, as well as partners who share family responsibilities, they don't have real choice. And until men are fully respected for contributing inside the home, they don't have real choice either. Equal opportunity is not equal unless everyone receives the encouragement that makes seizing those opportunities possible. Only then can both men and women achieve their full potential. None of this is attainable unless we pursue these goals together. Men need to support women, and I wish it went without saying, women need to support women too. Stanford professor Deborah Gruenfeld makes the case. We need to look out for one another, work together, and act more like a coalition. As individuals, we have relatively low levels of power. Working together, we are 50% of the population and therefore have real power. As obvious as this sounds, women have not always worked together in the past. In fact, there are many discouraging examples where women have actually done the opposite. We are a new generation, and we need a new approach. In the summer of 2012, my former Google colleague, Marissa Mayer, was named CEO of Yahoo. Like several of her friends and the Yahoo board, I knew that she was heading into her third trimester of pregnancy. Of course, many men take big jobs when their wives are weeks away from giving birth, and no one raises it as an issue. But Marissa's condition quickly became headline news. She was heralded as the first pregnant CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Feminists cheered. Then Marissa let it be known, "My maternity leave will be a few weeks long and I'll work throughout it." Many feminists stopped cheering. Since taking such a short leave is not feasible or desirable for everyone, they argued that Marissa was hurting the cause by setting up unreasonable expectations. So was this one giant leap forward for womankind and one baby step back? Of course not. Marissa became the youngest CEO of a Fortune 500 company while pregnant. She decided how she wanted to manage her career and family and never claimed that her choice should apply to anyone else. If she had cut Yahoo's maternity leave to 2 weeks for all employees, then concern would have been in order. She did not do this, but she was still roundly criticized. Even a European cabinet member weighed in. Like any individual, Marissa knows best what she is capable of, given her particular circumstances. And as journalist Kara Swisher also noted, Marissa has a husband who can actually take care of the child, and no one seems to remember that. Women who want to take 2 weeks off, or 2 days, or 2 years, or 20 years, deserve everyone's full support. As Marissa's experience demonstrates, women in powerful positions often receive greater scrutiny. Because the vast majority of leaders are men, it is not possible to generalize from any one example. But the dearth of female leaders causes one woman to be viewed as representative of her entire gender. And because people often discount and dislike female leaders, these generalizations are often critical. This is not just unfair to the individuals, but reinforces the stigma that successful women are unlikable. A perfect and personal example occurred in May 2012 when a Forbes blogger posted an article entitled, "Sheryl Sandberg is the Valley's It Girl, just like Kim Pulesi once was." He began his comparison by describing Kim, an early tech entrepreneur, as a luminary in the mid-1990s who never really earned her success, but was in the right place at the right time, and was young, pretty, and a good speaker. The blogger then argued, "I think Pulesi is a good cautionary tale for Sheryl Sandberg." Ouch. Kim and I had never met or spoken before this incident, but she defended both of us. In a published response, she described reading the blog post and how her immediate thought was, "How sad. How sad that as an industry and a society, we haven't advanced over these past 2 decades when it comes to views on women and leadership." As with all the past lazy, stereotype-ridden articles like this one, it gets the facts wrong. After correcting the facts, she continued, "Views like these are all too commonplace and part of a pervasive pattern that belittles, demeans, and marginalizes women as leaders." So many other readers joined her in calling the post sexist that the blogger posted an apology and retraction. I was grateful for Kim's vocal support. The more women can stick up for one another, the better. Sadly, this doesn't always happen. And it seems to happen even less when women voice a position that involves a gender-related issue. The attacks on Marissa for her maternity leave plans came almost entirely from other women. This has certainly been my experience, too. Everyone loves a fight, and they really love a catfight. The media will report endlessly about women attacking other women, which distracts from the real issues. When arguments turn into she said, we all lose. Every social movement struggles with dissension within its ranks, in part because advocates are passionate and unlikely to agree on every position and solution. Betty Friedan famously and foolishly refused to work with, or even to shake hands with, Gloria Steinem. They both did so much to further women's rights. But what if they had been able to work together? Couldn't they have furthered the cause even more? There are so many of us who care deeply about these matters. We should strive to resolve our differences quickly, and when we disagree, stay focused on our shared goals. This is not a plea for less debate, but for more constructive debate. In Marissa's case, it would have been great to keep the focus on her breakthrough achievements. Thanks to her high-profile appointment, other companies might consider hiring pregnant women for big jobs. And expectant mothers might be more inclined to apply for them. By diminishing Marissa's accomplishment, the attacks diminished us all. It is a painful truth that one of the obstacles to more women gaining power has sometimes been women already in power. Women in the generations ahead of me believed, largely correctly, that only one woman would be allowed to ascend to the senior ranks in any particular company. In the days of tokenism, Women looked around the room, and instead of bonding against an unfair system, they often viewed one another as competition. Ambition fueled hostility, and women wound up being ignored, undermined, and in some cases even sabotaged by other women. In the 1970s, this phenomenon was common enough that the term Queen Bee was used to describe a woman who flourished in a leadership role, especially in male-dominated industries, and who used her position to keep other female worker bees down. For some, it was simple self-preservation. For others, it reflected their coming of age in a society that believed men were superior to women. In this sense, queen bee behavior was not just a cause of gender discrimination, but also a consequence of that discrimination. Queen bees internalized the low status of women, and in order to feel worthy themselves, wanted only to associate with men. Often, these queen bees were rewarded for maintaining the status quo and not promoting other women. Unfortunately, this "there can be only one" attitude still lingers today. It makes no sense for women to feel that we are competing against one another anymore, but some still do. In certain instances, women question their female colleagues' level of career commitment, aggressiveness, and leadership abilities. One study found that female professors believed that male PhD students were more committed to their careers than female PhD students, even though a survey of the students found no gender difference in their reported levels of commitment. Other research suggests that once a woman achieves success, particularly in a gender-biased context, her capacity to see gender discrimination is reduced. It's heartbreaking to think about one woman holding another back. As former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, "There's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women." And the consequences extend beyond individual pain. Women's negative views of female co-workers are often seen as an objective assessment, more credible than the views of men. When women voice gender bias, they legitimize it. Obviously, a negative attitude cannot be gender-based if it comes from another woman, right? Wrong. Often without realizing it, women internalize disparaging cultural attitudes and then echo them back. As a result, women are not just victims of sexism, they can also be perpetrators. There is hope that this attitude is changing. A recent survey found that high-potential women working in business want to pay it forward, and 73% have reached out to other women to help them develop their talents. Almost all of the women I have encountered professionally have gone out of their way to be helpful. When I was a lowly summer intern at McKinsey, I met Diana Farrell, a star consultant, at a company-wide conference in Colorado. Diana had just spoken at a panel that I attended, and we bumped into each other afterward. Where else? In the women's room. We ended up having a talk that continued beyond the sinks, and she became a close friend and trusted advisor. Years later, she was one of the few who encouraged me to join Google. The more women help one another, the more we help ourselves. Acting like a coalition truly does produce results. In 2004, four female executives at Merrill Lynch started having lunch together once a month. They shared their accomplishments and frustrations. They brainstormed about business. After the lunches, they would all go back to their offices and tout one another's achievements. They couldn't brag about themselves, but they could easily do it for their colleagues. Their careers flourished, and each rose up the ranks to reach managing director and executive officer levels. The queen bee was banished, and the hive became stronger. I know that not every woman encounters this kind of positive female support, and yet, oddly, we often expect it. Most women don't assume that men will reach out and help, but with our own gender, we assume there will be a connection. We imagine women will act communally, and maybe we do so out of our own bias. Once in my career, I felt that a senior woman treated me poorly. She would complain about me and my team behind my back, but would not discuss any concerns she had with me, even when I asked directly. When I first met her, I had high hopes that she would be an ally. When she turned out to be not just unhelpful but actually spiteful, I was not just disappointed. I felt betrayed. Sharon Mears explained to me that this feeling of betrayal was predictable. Both men and women do, in fact, demand more time and warmth from women in the workplace. We expect greater niceness from women and can become angry when they don't conform to that expectation. I think that's a big part of the protest about executive women being mean to other women, Sharon told me. I think it's about a double standard we have when we look at female versus male superiors. I now recognize that had this senior woman been a man and acted the same way, I still would have been frustrated, but I wouldn't have taken it so personally. It's time to drop the double standard. Gender should neither magnify nor excuse rude and dismissive treatment. We should expect professional behavior and even kindness from everyone. Any coalition of support must also include men, many of whom care about gender inequality as much as women do. In 2012, Kunal Modi, a student at Harvard's Kennedy School, wrote an article imploring men to man up on family and workplace issues. He argued that, for the sake of American corporate performance and shareholder returns, men must play an active role in ensuring that the most talented young workers, often women, are being encouraged to advocate for their career advancement. So men, let's get involved now, and not in a patronizing manner that marginalizes this as some altruistic act on behalf of our mothers, wives, and daughters, but on behalf of ourselves, our companies, and the future of our country. I applaud Kunal's message, especially his focus on active engagement. Men of all ages must commit to changing the leadership ratios. They can start by actively seeking out qualified female candidates to hire and promote. And if qualified candidates cannot be found, then we need to invest in more recruiting, mentoring, and sponsoring so women can get the necessary experience. An us-versus-them crusade will not move us toward true equality. Nor will an us-versus-us crusade, which UC Hastings law professor Joan Williams calls the gender wars. These wars are being waged on many fronts, but the mommy wars, which pit mothers who work outside the home against mothers who work inside the home, attract the most attention. As Professor Williams explains, these mommy wars are so bitter because both groups' identities are at stake because of another clash of social ideals. The ideal worker is defined as someone always available for work, and the good mother is defined as always available to her children. So ideal worker women need to prove that, although they weren't always there, their children are fine, fine, fine. Women who have rejected the ideal worker norm and settled for a slower career, or no career, need to prove that their compromise was necessary for the good of their families. So you have each group of women judging the other, because neither group of women has been able to live up to inconsistent ideals. Professor Williams is absolutely right. One of the conflicts inherent in having choice is that we all make different ones. There is always an opportunity cost, and I don't know any woman who feels comfortable with all her decisions. As a result, we inadvertently hold that discomfort against those who remind us of the path not taken. Guilt and insecurity make us second-guess ourselves and, in turn, resent one another. In a letter to The Atlantic in June 2012, Barnard President Deborah Spar wrote about this messy and complicated emotion, exploring why she and so many successful women feel so guilty. She decided that it's because women have been subtly striving all our lives to prove that we have picked up the torch that feminism provided, that we haven't failed the mothers and grandmothers who made our ambitions possible. And yet, in a deep and profound way, we are failing. Because feminism wasn't supposed to make us feel guilty or prod us into constant competitions over who is raising children better, organizing more cooperative marriages, or getting less sleep. It was supposed to make us free, to give us not only choices, but the ability to make these choices without constantly feeling that we'd somehow gotten it wrong. Stay-at-home mothers can make me feel guilty, and at times, intimidate me. There are moments when I feel like they are judging me, and I imagine there are moments when they feel like I am judging them. But when I push past my own feelings of guilt and insecurity, I feel grateful. These parents, mostly mothers, constitute a large amount of the talent that helps sustain our schools, nonprofits, and communities. Remember that mom who pointed out that my son should be wearing a green t-shirt on St. Patrick's Day? She is a tireless volunteer in the classroom and our community. So many people benefit from her hard work. Society has long undervalued the contributions of those who work without a salary. My mother felt this slight keenly. For 17 years, she worked more than full-time as a mother and on behalf of Soviet Jewry. She understood that the compensation for her efforts was making a difference in the lives of persecuted people halfway across the world. But many people in her own neighborhood did not consider her work to be as important as a real job. She was still regarded as just a housewife, undercutting the very real but unpaid work of raising children and advocating for human rights. We all want the same thing: to feel comfortable with our choices and to feel validated by those around us. So let's start by validating one another. Mothers who work outside the home should regard mothers who work inside the home as real workers. And mothers who work inside the home should be equally respectful of those choosing another option. A few years ago, on a visit to the U.S. Naval Academy, I met an extraordinary woman who was about to join the U.S. Submarine Force as one of its first female officers. She was nervous about her new role and aware that there were risks in being an officer and not a gentleman. I asked her to let me know how it went. A year later, she followed up with a heartfelt email. "Truthfully, I was prepared for opposition and the possibility of being discounted," she wrote. "But it did not happen. I was respected the moment I stepped on board, and I can truly say that I am a valued part of the crew." Unfortunately, she told me that she encountered resentment from another source, the Navy wives. At an onshore welcome dinner, the wives of her colleagues pounced and accused her of being a bra-burning feminist out to prove a point. They forced her to defend her career choice, reputation, and personal life. "I was shocked. Talk about uncomfortable," she wrote. I did my best to answer their questions and stand my ground. Eventually, they backed off and started in on my husband. We must work harder to rise above this. The gender wars need an immediate and lasting peace. True equality will be achieved only when we all fight the stereotypes that hold us back. Feeling threatened by others' choices pulls us all down. Instead, we should funnel our energy into breaking this cycle. Sharon Mears tells a story about a school parents' night she attended, in which the children introduced their parents. Sharon's daughter Sammy pointed at her father and said, "This is Steve. He makes buildings, kind of like an architect, and he loves to sing." Then Sammy pointed at Sharon and said, "This is Sharon. She wrote a book, she works full-time, and she never picks me up from school." To Sharon's credit, hearing this account did not make her feel guilty. Instead, she said, "I felt mad at the social norms that make my daughter feel odd because her mother doesn't conform to those norms." The goal is to work toward a world where those social norms no longer exist. If more children see fathers at school pickups and mothers who are busy at jobs, both girls and boys will envision more options for themselves. Expectations will not be set by gender, but by personal passion, talents, and interests. I am fully aware that most women are not focused on changing social norms for the next generation, but simply trying to get through each day.
40% of employed mothers lack sick days and vacation leave, and about 50% of employed mothers are unable to take time off to care for a sick child.
Only about half of women receive any pay during maternity leave. These policies can have severe consequences. Families with no access to paid family leave often go into debt and can fall into poverty. Part-time jobs with fluctuating schedules offer little chance to plan and often stop short of the 40-hour week that provides basic benefits. Too many work standards remain inflexible and unfair, often penalizing women with children. Too many talented women try their hardest to reach the top and bump up against systemic barriers. So many others pull back because they do not think they have a choice. All of this brings me back to Lema Bowie's insistence that we need more women in power. When leadership insists that these policies change, they will. Google put in pregnancy parking when I asked for it, and it remains there long after I left. We must raise both the ceiling and the floor. My mother had fewer choices than I did. But with my father's support, she has always worked hard. During my childhood, she chose to be a devoted mother and volunteer. When I left for college, she went back to school to study teaching English as a second language. She taught full-time for 15 years and felt that teaching was her calling. At one point, I was asked to become the administrator for the entire school, my mother told me. I said no, preferring to stay in the classroom and work with my students. I was exactly where I wanted to be. In 2003, my mother left the workforce to take care of her ailing parents. She was sorry to leave her teaching career, but family has always been her top priority. After my grandparents passed away, she re-entered the workforce. She founded Earpiece, Save Your Hearing, a nonprofit to prevent noise-induced hearing loss in young people. At the age of 65, she has returned to her love of teaching, running workshops and speaking to students from elementary to high school. My mother has leaned in her entire life. She raised her children, helped her parents spend their final years in dignity and comfort, and continues to be a dedicated and loving wife, mother, and grandmother. She has always contributed to her community and the world. She is my inspiration. My mother wants to see society achieve true equality. She sees the barriers that women still face, but she also sees new opportunities. She believes that what I have achieved and much more is possible for many others. I agree. And more important, so many women that I have encountered agree. Filled with energy, optimism, and self-confidence, they are scrambling along that jungle gym and moving toward their long-term dream. It's up to us to end the self-fulfilling belief that women can't do this, women can't do that. Throwing up our hands and saying it can't be done ensures that it will never be done. I have written this book to encourage women to dream big, forge a path through the obstacles, and achieve their full potential. I am hoping that each woman will set her own goals and reach for them with gusto. And I am hoping that each man will do his part to support women in the workplace and in the home, also with gusto. As we start using the talents of the entire population, our institutions will be more productive, our homes will be happier, and the children growing up in those homes will no longer be held back by narrow stereotypes. I know that for many women, getting to the top of their organization is far from their primary focus. My intention is not to exclude them or ignore their valid concerns. I believe that if more women lean in We can change the power structure of our world and expand opportunities for all. More female leadership will lead to fairer treatment for all women. Shared experience forms the basis of empathy, and in turn, can spark the institutional changes we need. Critics have scoffed at me for trusting that once women are in power, they will help one another, since that has not always been the case. I'm willing to take that bet. The first wave of women who ascended to leadership positions were few and far between, and to survive, many focused more on fitting in than on helping others. The current wave of female leadership is increasingly willing to speak up. The more women attain positions of power, the less pressure there will be to conform, and the more they will do for other women. Research already suggests that companies with more women in leadership roles have better work-life policies, smaller gender gaps in executive compensation, and more women in mid-level management. The hard work of generations before us means that equality is within our reach. We can close the leadership gap now. Each individual's success can make success a little easier for the next. We can do this for ourselves, for one another, for our daughters, and for our sons. If we push hard now, this next wave can be the last wave. In the future, there will be no female leaders. There will just be leaders. When Gloria Steinem marched in the streets to fight for the opportunities that so many of us now take for granted, she quoted Susan B. Anthony, who marched in the streets before her and concluded, "Our job is not to make young women grateful. It is to make them ungrateful so they keep going." The sentiment remains true today. We need to be grateful for what we have, but dissatisfied with the status quo. This dissatisfaction spurs the charge for change. We must keep going. The march toward true equality continues. It continues down the halls of governments, corporations, academia, hospitals, law firms, nonprofits, research labs, and every organization, large and small. We owe it to the generations that came before us and the generations that will come after to keep fighting. I believe women can lead more in the workplace. I believe men can contribute more in the home. And I believe that this will create a better world, one where half our institutions are run by women and half our homes are run by men. I look toward the world I want for all children and my own. My greatest hope is that my son and my daughter will be able to choose what to do with their lives without external or internal obstacles slowing them down or making them question their choices. If my son wants to do the important work of raising children full-time, I hope he is respected and supported. And if my daughter wants to work full-time outside her home, I hope she is not just respected and supported, but also liked for her achievements. I hope they both end up exactly where they want to be. And when they find where their true passions lie, I hope they both lean in all the way.
Sarah's story. I overcame my fear and ran for mayor of my town. I can still remember how the phone conversation went. "Sarah, the mayor is not running for re-election. You should consider running." I responded with, "No, I'm not qualified." Now, in reality, I was as qualified as the mayor who was stepping down. I have a master's degree in public administration. I work for a public agency that connects me to all of our local cities and community leaders. I sit on the Polk County Conservation Board. I am a member of the Planning and Zoning Commission and have served on other boards and committees in my city. So why did I so quickly insist that I wasn't qualified? My next rationale for why I should not run for mayor was even better than the first. I can't. I have two young children. Later that night, before going to bed, I began reading Chapter 7 of Lean In, Don't Leave Before You Leave. I finished the chapter and had a realization. I was holding myself back by believing that I couldn't be both a good mayor and a good mother. In general, I am a strong, independent woman who is used to challenging the world around me. But in that moment, I was shutting myself out of an opportunity. No man would say, "No, I can't run for office because I have two young children at home. I can't be a good dad and a good mayor." So the next day, I made it known that I would be running for mayor of Pleasant Hill, Iowa. I had officially leaned in. While I was campaigning, most of the conversations went as follows. Man: "Wow, you could be the first female mayor of our city. That's great. So tell me, what did your husband say? Is he okay with you running?" Man: "It would be great to have you as our mayor. You have excellent credentials. But is your skin thick enough for this?" My guess is that those questions are not asked nearly as frequently of male candidates, if asked at all. Even as I became more and more aware of stereotypes I had to overcome, I found myself once again making a blunder. Right before a fundraising event, I coached my husband on how to answer a question. "If anyone asks us if we have kids, just say yes, two boys," I told him. "Don't tell them their ages unless they ask." Our sons were 11 months and 2.5 years old at the time, and I was petrified that someone would think that only a heartless mother would run for office when her kids were so young. In reality, that is not the case at all. I am a mother and a passionate public servant. Who is to say that I am not capable of being both? I was elected mayor of my town on November 5, 2013, with 78% of the vote. At the age of 29, I made history as the youngest and first female mayor of my city. Even now that I'm in office, there are some who still ask, "How can you do this when you have two young children at home?" My very calm response is always the same. Why are men allowed to do that and women are not? Sarah Kurovsky is the mayor of Pleasant Hill, Iowa. Allison's story. We are not left over. We are leaning in. "You have a boyfriend, right? When are you getting married?" asked my middle-aged manager. "Remember," he advised, "sooner is always better than later at your age." "I am 27. I have a boyfriend, and we've been dating for more than 2 years. We are happy the way things are." Yet this is the kind of comment I hear often. Of the 80 people in my department at work, I am one of 3 women aged 27 or older who are not married. I am under constant scrutiny. In China, where I work for a state-owned bank, I am considered sheng nu, or leftover. The idea of the leftover woman is simple. No matter how many accomplishments, advanced degrees, or professional and personal accolades a woman acquires, if she is past her mid-20s and still single, she is a failure. In the eyes of mainstream society, we are unwanted, decreasing in value day by day. On the surface, there are a lot of things about the state of women in China that are ahead of much of the world. Most companies here provide 3 to 6 months of paid maternity leave. Compared to our neighbors like Japan and South Korea, the proportion of working Chinese women is much larger. And yet the warnings about becoming left over come from all directions, pressuring young women to prioritize family over career. When I first read Lean In, I couldn't help but think that women in China need to hear this. I started talking with a friend, and we decided to form a Lean In circle to discuss these issues. We now have 12 women, all in our 20s and 30s, from mainland China, Hong Kong, the United States, and Singapore, who meet twice each month. We work in law, philanthropy, finance, media, and telecommunications. 2 of us are married. 1 of us is taking time off to focus on her young child. Most of us are left over. It can be hard to apply some of the lessons of Lean In to the Chinese workplace. At my company, for example, There's no such thing as going to your boss and asking for a raise. Salaries are non-negotiable. The culture in Chinese state-owned companies does not reward taking initiative or risks. Women who are aggressive, outspoken, and stand out are marginalized. There are no easy solutions to these problems, but we are trying to work through them as a group. Our team has helped create more lean-in circles throughout Beijing. We are working to connect with successful female business leaders to provide positive role models. Of course, we are still dating and getting married. We share stories about romance, but we are also working together to understand that our identities and worth should not be determined by our marital status. We have realized that creating a community makes us stronger. We are not leftover women. We are women leaning in, China style. Allison Yi is a 27-year-old communications professional in Beijing, China. Chapter 12. Own Who You Are. Melody Hobson. Recently, a woman stopped me at a conference and said, "I heard you speak about 10 years ago, and you said something that completely blew me away." Obviously, I was intrigued. She continued, "You were on a panel and proclaimed, 'I feel bad for white women.' Everyone in the room stiffened. Then you explained, 'As black women, we know from early childhood that we are going to be discriminated against. It is a fact that runs through most of our lives. So when we get to corporate America, there are no surprises for us. White women, however, are in shock.'" In this book, Cheryl writes that she graduated from college believing that equality would be achieved in our generation. I was raised to know we still had a long way to go. Once, I came home from a birthday party where I was the only black kid invited, and the first question my mother asked was, "How did they treat you?" I responded, "Why would they treat me differently?" And she said, "They're not always going to treat you well." I was 7. My mother was ruthlessly realistic. The third rail. I understand why the white women at the conference stiffened when I pointed out this difference. Gender in the workplace is a difficult topic by itself. Complicating it further with race makes it that much more challenging. Despite the breakthrough election of President Obama, race in America remains a controversial and historically shameful issue. Any mention of it seems taboo. It's the conversational equivalent of touching the third rail. The effect is shock followed by a long silence. Many of Cheryl's friends advised her not to speak out about gender, insisting it would kill her career. Many of my friends shared a similar concern when I decided to write this chapter. One practically grabbed me by the lapels and implored me not to get sucked into the race thing. She worried that I'd come across as one-dimensional, where all roads lead back to prejudice. And yet I feel compelled to speak out because my mother's question still hangs in the air. How did they treat you? While a black president clearly represents progress, racism is far from dead and sexism isn't either. Over my 22 years in the workplace, I have faced repeated and stubborn bias. Of course, I do not pretend to speak for all women of color. No one person can speak for all. We are each unique, which is why it is so wrong to be lumped together by stereotypes or viewed with narrowed expectations based on skin color or chromosomes. The irony is that dealing with this prejudice becomes our shared experience. Closing the achievement gap. All women struggle. But women of color must overcome double jeopardy, the 1-2 punch of sexism and racism. The achievement gap between women and men is wider in the African American and Latino communities than it is in the white community. The educational gap between men and women is more pronounced among African Americans and Latinos, with women earning even more degrees relative to men. Yet this educational achievement is not translating into higher pay or greater leadership roles. For every dollar a white man earns in the United States, white women earn 78 cents. African American women earn 64.5 cents. and Latina women earn just 54 cents. Of the Fortune 500 companies, only 6 have a Black CEO and only 1 is a woman. About 70% of corporate board seats are held by white men, and 30% of Fortune 250 companies don't have a single Black board member. This matters because there is a direct correlation between board diversity and diversity in the executive ranks. Only 2 publicly traded companies are chaired by a Black woman. Ursula Burns, CEO of Xerox, is one. I am the other. I have always been ambitious, and I say that with pride. I am the youngest of 6 kids, raised by a single mother who married at 19 and had 4 children by the age of 24. I was not planned. My oldest sister is more than 2 decades older than I am, and my closest sibling is 9 years older. Although I have my father's name, I never really knew him, and my parents never married. I adored my mother for the unconditional love and encouragement she offered along with her realism. When I was 5, I wondered out loud about what present Santa might bring me and was informed point blank, "Mommy is Santa." Years later, when I asked my mother why she didn't attend PTA meetings like the other moms, she responded, "Your mom doesn't have that luxury." She said it without apologies or guilt. "It is what it is," has been a mantra throughout my life. Still, my mother remained optimistic. As often as she told me that life isn't fair, she also told me, "You can do anything." She was extraordinarily industrious and would always wake up before sunrise. She would then rouse me, saying, "If you sleep past 6 a.m., life will pass you by." To this day, I am my mother's daughter, often rising by 4 in the morning during the week. Her own options were limited by both her circumstances and her choices. She went into the real estate business, converting old buildings into condominiums, but her work ethic and gut instincts were not enough to drive success. For most of my life, she was a study in contrast, working extremely hard but consistently unable to make ends meet. In her aspirations for me to have the best, she sometimes overextended herself, buying Easter dresses instead of paying the phone bill. Sometimes we lived in apartments in downtown Chicago, close to one of the country's best public grade schools, which I was fortunate to attend. We were frequently evicted, and when things got really rough, we would move to the South Side, living in partially completed apartments, isolated to a room or two, and at times heating water for baths on hot plates. While my childhood was often unsettling, it was not as difficult as some. School provided tremendous stability for me. I was good at it, too. Even in the hardest classes up against the top students, I excelled. I had to. One thing I have learned is that there is little tolerance for error if you're a woman, and zero tolerance if you're a woman of color. That's why when one of us achieves, we crush it. After high school, I headed to Princeton. When this comes up with older folks in professional settings, they sometimes look at me in a way that almost makes me feel like I need to add, "No, I did not take your kid's spot." It amazes me how often some make disheartening insinuations that race got me into the Ivy League. The not at all subtle implication is that my achievements aren't real. This suspicious attitude follows most Black people in the workforce, including a chief resident at a top New York City hospital, where patients constantly ask her, "Where did you go to medical school?" She asked fellow residents if they received the same grilling. All the white males said no. Her one Black male colleague said yes. Minorities so often get the worst of both worlds: the assumption of affirmative action without the help of actual diversity programs. I am an unabashed advocate for affirmative action to help offset centuries of slavery and institutionalized racism. There is still much to be done to ensure fairness, equality, and inclusion. Some people of color share my views, and others believe these programs hold us back by implying that we are not as good. I respect differences of opinion on this issue. In the end, we all want the same thing. When we are hired, we don't want any standards to be lowered, We just want those standards to be applied consistently. And we should not pit minorities and women against each other. I have heard so many executives point to white female advancement as a clear signal of progress. When pressed about advancements among people of color, they immediately refer back to white women. This is dangerous, because it suggests diversity and inclusion are a zero-sum game where some win at others' expense. I was desperate to understand money as a child, so it is no accident that I went into the investment field. After graduating from Princeton with a degree in international relations and public policy, I joined Chicago-based Ariel Investments in client services and marketing. Within a few years, I had worked my way up to be an informal chief of staff to John Rogers, Ariel's founder and my mentor. Soon after I turned 31, I was named president and remain in that position today. Even though I will never be evicted again, I am haunted by those times and still work relentlessly. When I think of my career and why I leaned in, it comes down to basic survival. A din of anxiety born out of the dissonance of my childhood stayed with me, drove me. I leaned in, all in, because I felt I had no other choice. Go all in. It would be lovely to think that my success was a result of being extraordinary, but the answer is far more boring. I worked hard, really hard, and that is the key. I was competing with people who were more knowledgeable and better connected. The one thing I knew I could do is outwork everybody. I also learned early how to study others. I am in some ways the quintessential inside-outsider. All through my life, I've kept an eye out for people who were doing cool things, and I took notes. I still do. When I meet interesting people, I ask them how they spend their day and whom they admire. Some have even remarked that meeting me is like being interviewed. It is not always a compliment, but I can take it. It's worth it to me to keep learning. Like everyone who succeeds, I had help from others. My first day at Ariel, John gave me an important piece of advice. He explained that I was going to be in a room with people who made a lot of money and had huge titles, but he advised, "Don't assume that just because you are new and young that you don't have great ideas. I want them." John instilled in me the value of speaking up. He also instilled in me the value of listening. For the first 2 years, he took me to all of his meetings, and I heard him pitch Ariel over and over. After the first few months, I started to play a game in my head. Someone would ask John a question, and I would try to answer it silently before he did. When I could match his answer, I knew I was getting it. Then I took the game a step further. I started pressing myself. Do I have an even better answer? When I thought I did, I would tell him. The first time, John was taken aback. I mean, Ariel was his firm. But when my answer was an improvement, he acknowledged it, thanked me, and offered me even more responsibility. John's belief in my abilities gave me a seat at the table and a voice early on. Even if you don't have that support from the top, I urge you to participate fully, not in a smug or cocky way, but with humility, combined with confidence. If you have an idea, don't hesitate to tell a colleague. Be willing to speak up and stand out. I've seen so many young women hang back, adopting the attitude, "Tell me what you expect me to be and I'll be it." A far better approach is to say, "This is who I am and I have value. I hope you will accept it, but if you don't, I'm still good with who I am." Battling stereotypes. In my 20s, I crossed paths with a high-ranking woman at a major communications company and asked her for advice. "Smile a lot," she replied. This struck me as a superficial comment until she dove into its deeper importance. "We all want to work with people who are happy and optimistic," she explained. "We want to work with energy givers, not energy takers." She was right. I decided that in addition to being considered smart and conscientious, I also wanted to be someone who projected happiness. This is especially important for Black women, who must deal with the stereotype that we are angry. The parallel for Latinas is that they are overly emotional hotheads. Just watch the character Gloria Delgado Pritchett on Modern Family. I am still amazed by the number of people who meet me for the first time and say, "You are so much nicer than I thought you would be." After some years, I realized the percentage